All right, so my name is Christine Carmichael, and I'm a doctoral candidate in the Department of Forestry at Michigan State here. And it's May 6th, 2015, about 2 p.m., and we're here at the Voice Library at Michigan State. And I have the great privilege and exciting opportunity to talk with my father, Dr. Jack Carmichael, who received his Ph.D. in chemistry from Michigan State 50 or 51 years ago.
51 years ago.
51 years ago. And I also am a Spartan alum from my bachelor education, so we are a Spartan family through and through. So it's very exciting to have my dad here today, and just going to talk about your life and influences and a lot of exciting things. So just to get everyone oriented, so you were born in 1938, and you're an only child of the Depression era, and you grew up in Ravenswood, West Virginia, which has a population of about 1,000, not quite very large. So what was life like growing up in Ravenswood, and how would you describe your childhood?
Well, Christine, it's a great pleasure to be here with you, and that we're going to be someday soon Spartan PhD legacy. And going to my childhood now in Ravenswood, West Virginia, I grew up in a small community where everyone knew everyone else. And it wasn't a case just knowing the next-door neighbor. You actually knew the people down the street in the next block, two blocks away. Everyone in the town pretty much knew and took care of everyone else, not the way the culture has gone nowadays. Mm. So some of the salient features of my early life in Ravenswood were going through elementary school that was built around the period of the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
And I went through the first 6 grades there, and then the high school was quite small. So it was actually 7th and 8th grade were incorporated in the high school, and you started in the high school building as a 7th grader. And that's when I joined the band, actually. Mm-hmm. And I was in the band all through high school. And I was very fortunate to excel as a student in Ravenswood. And I remember the third grade teacher told my mother that I was the best student she'd ever had. And that was a great thrill for me to hear in later years.
Mm-hmm. Very encouraging.
So when I was in Ravenswood, Boy Scouts was also an important part of my life. And I joined as a Cub Scout, was in the Cub Scouts for 3 years, then joined the Boy Scouts. And one of the great achievements of my early life was earning the Eagle Scout Award. And later, when I was a little older, 17 years old, 18 years old, I became a junior assistant scoutmaster and helped take a troop of young boys to camp.
So that must have had a very significant influence on your childhood. And
well, it did. And actually, taking the boys to camp was one of my first teaching experiences, and I've been a teacher off and on my entire adult life. Let me mention some other aspects of my early days at the high school. I was very active in the school plays, and as a senior, I was voted best thespian.
So comfortable in front of crowds.
Yes.
that runs in the family.
Then I was National Honor Society, and as a senior, I was valedictorian of the high school class.
And I would actually like to note, too, both of your parents were valedictorian.
Not in Ravenswood, but one in Ravenswood. My father went to Ravenswood High School. My mother went to East Liverpool High School in East Liverpool, Ohio. And also in my early days, I worked in the family business as a young boy and throughout high school. My grandparents had a business called the Trenley Blake China Company. They made hotel and restaurant china, and at that time it was the largest employer in Jackson County. And I started stamping cards for bills of lading in the office as a young boy, putting the company stamp on blank bills of ladings and cards for shipping. And then as I got older, they transferred me out into the plant, and I started doing packing. And I packed cartons of dishes of all sorts, from the little, what they call butters, up to full-size dinner plates for shipping out to clients all over the country.
So you had your first working experience in your family's pottery business, but pottery was not meant to be your calling.
No, it wasn't, but I learned a work ethic from my grandparents, especially my grandmother. She was always up early in the morning and always on the job, working hard all day. And I can remember my grandmother saying, "Jack, you've got to stick to it." And I guess that lesson stood with me for the rest of my life. I've always been a stick-to-itive person.
And I hear that from you as well whenever I have tough times, quite a bit. So
while I was in Ravenswood, the fellow that lived across the street from my grandparents went to Ohio Wesleyan University. And I knew him. He was an athlete and on the basketball team and the football team. And I knew him as a young boy. And he encouraged me to go visit Ohio Wesleyan as a possible place for my undergraduate experience. So I did. I went out there and visited him in the fraternity house, in the Beta Theta Pi fraternity house, and got acquainted with a lot of the fellows and went on campus and met some of the professors. And I can remember my grandfather was a little bit leery of Ohio Wesleyan because it was a Methodist school and he was Presbyterian. But then he was greatly relieved to find out that the chairman of the physics department was Presbyterian. So he approved of my going to that particular school then in the following fall.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall of 1955, I matriculated at Ohio Wesleyan University.
Wow. And so what were some of your really most memorable experiences being at Ohio Wesleyan? You obviously were in a fraternity, and as you've told me before, I know the stories about being president of the fraternity. Obviously, you had a strong leadership instinct. But what were some, I guess, other memorable experiences when you were at college?
Well,
in the 50s. That's an interesting
time frame.
Yes.
In the 50s, I was very active in all my classes. It was a liberal arts institution. So we took English and philosophy and religion and art appreciation and music appreciation and speech and political science and social science, and we got well-rounded in our education. So I majored in chemistry and also in physics, and then while I was at Ohio Wesleyan, I was initiated into the chemistry, the mathematics, and the sophomore scholastic honorary societies.
So you're continuing achievements.
Continuing academic achievements,
yeah.
Stood with me through Ohio Wesleyan. And one of the biggest occasions I remember as a senior, I was elected chairman of Greek Week. And Greek Week was a series in which all the fraternities and sororities put on special programs, usually academic programs, emphasizing the work that they were doing in the community, work they were doing academically. And it was all coordinated, and I had the great opportunity to be chairman. And Ohio Wesleyan had not had a Greek Week for many, many years, so this was a rebirth of Greek Week that I was in charge of back then.
Yeah.
And I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Chemistry and Physics in 1959.
Yeah, this is a very interesting time because at that point you moved to Midland, Michigan, to accept a position in 1960 with Dow Corning. And that's obviously, at this point in your career, you're in a chemistry field, but not necessarily the environmental field, which we're going to talk about in your later career. But this was really the beginning of your professional life. And tell me, also, actually, at this time, you began graduate classes as well while you were at Dow Corning in Midland. And fun fact that you were in the inaugural class that moved into Owen Hall at Michigan State. And I can't believe this, but you lived on $200 a month.
A month, that's right. $200 a month.
That is incredible.
That was our graduate stipend. But first, I had the luxury of earning $500 a month when I started at Dow Corning. And I was a development chemist in product development in 59 and 60. And I learned about all aspects of the silicone product line that Dow Corning manufactured back then. I worked on silicone rubber. And while I was at Dow Corning, as you said, I took graduate classes at Michigan State that they taught in Midland. There were three programs. Central had a program in bachelor's, a master's program in business administration. University of Michigan had one in chemical engineering, and Michigan State had one in chemistry. So I took three chemistry courses, and it was hard to work all day and take classes at night, but I managed. And about partway through the second course, I applied to Michigan State for assistantship, for admission to graduate school, and also for an assistantship.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, they accepted me, and they gave me a teaching assistantship in freshman chemistry. So in the fall of 1960, I went back to Michigan State and matriculated in graduate school.
Wow, so 1960, that is quite an era, I think, in any place in the United States. But particularly, tell me your impression about the cultural atmosphere at Michigan State during that time that you were here.
Well, Michigan State was much smaller, of course, back in 1960, about 20,000 students. And they had just finished construction of the Owen Graduate Center, which I moved into. I was the first class to live in the Owen Graduate Center. And they had a wing for young men and a wing for young women. And it was an easy place to meet people, to get acclimated into the campus. And I met many people from my experience in Owen Hall.
So that doesn't seem to have changed, because I've had a very similar experience meeting quite a few people at Michigan State pretty easily.
Well, of course, I also met many, many people in the chemistry department when I got settled in and started taking courses. And they gave us a pretty rigorous program in chemistry. They had four branches of chemistry at that time: physical, organic, analytical, and inorganic. And you had to pass qualifying exams in three of the four areas of chemistry in order to be accepted in a preliminary way to the PhD program. So it took me two tries, but I finally passed all three exams, and then during my first year, I was teaching in the chemistry majors program as a grad lab assistant and also teaching recitation classes. Then my second year, they moved me up to the PChem course, the physical chemistry course for non-majors. I was assistant in that course. And then after that, I had a research fellowship. My major professor had a grant for high-temperature materials from the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I slid right into that program because I had been working on high-temperature materials earlier at Dow Corning during my first year out of undergraduate school.
Hmm.
So I kept on going in the area of high-temperature materials and the properties of polymers in that family. And my PhD dissertation was called A Statistical Study of the Structure of the Dimethyl Siloxane Chain and Rings. And I finished actually all my courses and my preliminary exams and the first draft of my dissertation in September of 63. But then my professor went to Holland for a year of sabbatical.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, you finished your PhD in
1964.
Because
I went back to Midland to work.
Right.
And from 63 to 66. And while I was in Midland, I worked on the revising of my PhD dissertation and sent it back and forth to Holland to my professor. And then my degree was actually awarded in 64, my PhD.
Yeah. What were some of the main lessons you learned about yourself throughout this experience of getting a PhD at Michigan State?
Well, I learned that you had to be self-reliant. There was no one that was going to do it but me. And I had to, and my grandmother always said, I had to stick to it. And especially when the year that I was on my own, when my professor was off in Holland and I had to revise my dissertation, I worked almost every evening on my dissertation the first year I was working in Midland, back when at that time. And I eventually rose to director of the Polymer Development Laboratory at Dow Corning. And while I was there, I was selected for membership in the Scientific Research Society of America. And once I had received my PhD, I taught two physics courses in the evenings at Saginaw Valley University. At that time, it was Saginaw Valley College. And in fact, I was faculty for the first graduating class of Saginaw Valley College back in 1966, I believe that was.
Wow.
Or 65.
So there wasn't a dull moment, really. You were working.
I was busy the whole time.
Yeah.
And then when I finished at Dow Corning, publications were an important part of my life. I published several scientific publications, three from my PhD research and about seven or eight more from my years at Dow Corning, all on the in the general subject matter of high-temperature materials.
So this is interesting because a lot of your early career, like we talked about up to this point, has been focused on silicone polymers and very technical industry, but not necessarily addressing environmental issues.
No, but that comes later because then I did a postdoctoral at the University of Oregon.
Right, and that was in 1967?
67. One of my professors from Michigan State, his professor was a senior member of the faculty at the University of Oregon and a member of the National Science Foundation. A member of the National Academy of Sciences. And he had a grant from the National Science Foundation and hired me as a postdoctoral. And I worked on stochastic processes, which are probabilistic rate processes. And I worked on that for a year under him out in Oregon. And
Now, that was the time you had mentioned to me was socially significant to you because of some of the people that you had met there.
That's right. That's right. I met several Africans while I was in Oregon. I met them in they worked in the science building, some of them, and they were all Kenyans. There were about a dozen Kenyans studying at University of Oregon in graduate school at that time.
Just somewhat surprising for someone nowadays to think about that occurring in 1967.
That's true. And I got to know all these fellows. And years later, when I was with the United Nations and the United Nations sent me off into Kenya, these guys treated me like a long-lost brother when I showed up in Kenya. And they took me all around the countryside, introduced me to the families, took me to the small villages, took me on a safari.
Wow.
And I had a great time, all as a result of interacting with these guys at the University of Oregon years before.
Man, a lot of good relationships formed. Seems to be a trend in your life as well that I've noticed is that you've maintained so many amazing relationships with people over decades. And that's really admirable because it takes some work to do that. So you had met so many people at University of Oregon in 1967, but you were only there a year.
That's right.
And then you took
then
a position
I went to the
at
University
UMass.
Of Massachusetts.
Right.
And at the University of Massachusetts, I worked as an assistant professor. I taught and I did research, and I did research mostly in the polymer field. I was assistant professor of polymer science and engineering. But about halfway through my career at UMass, I decided to do a sharp 180-degree turn, and I shifted into the environmental field.
Now, what inspired that shift?
Well, I decided that I had worked in a narrow area of science too long, and it was time to broaden out and try to attack some of the greater problems that were facing society. And it seemed to me, with my natural ability in science and my background in science, that environmental problems was a natural area for me to branch off into.
Mm-hmm.
So I was one of a group of professors that was sent down to the Tennessee Valley Authority in 69, I think it was, to study the situation down there. And at that time, they had a whole bunch of coal-fired power plants producing power for the region of the Tennessee area, and also including parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama. And they were producing the power from high-sulfur coal.
I remember this
soft
story.
Soft coal. And the high-sulfur coal, when you burn it, produces sulfur dioxide, which combines with moisture in the atmosphere to produce sulfurous and sulfuric acid, which comes down as what everyone knows now as acid rain. So the solution that these guys adopted back then was to build higher and higher smokestacks to disperse the SO2 over a bigger and bigger region. And what they ended up doing was killing the trout in all the streams of the Tennessee Valley.
Unbelievable.
And I pointed out this problem to them when we were visiting during a seminar, and the chairman of the program said, "Well, a fool asks more questions than a wise man can answer." And I brought this up in later years to illustrate that if you're in the field like the environment that's controversial, you have to be expect people to try to bring you down, to try to muster arguments against you, and you have to be persistent. As my grandmother said again, you've got to stick with it, Jack. You've got to stick with it.
It's a very relevant sentiment to apply to very many fields in your life.
Very relevant.
Especially in the concerns of environment. I mean, there's a lot of people involved in controversies, so you need to be able to stick to your ethics on that. So that was a really influential time in your life at University of Massachusetts, not only because you shifted to working on environmental issues, but I wanted you to also mention, because I think this is very relevant nowadays, given the issues we've experienced recently in the U.S., but you actively sought out grants to recruit African-American students from historically black colleges in the South between 1967 and 1970 to come to the northern area, to the University of Massachusetts in particular, to pursue better opportunities for graduate school.
That's correct.
That's really mind-blowing.
I developed a program for the graduate education of black students in the sciences at the University of Massachusetts, and I was successful in obtaining funding for this from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation in New York. Then I organized a recruiting, and including a recruiting visit to black colleges throughout the South, and this was during the Civil Rights era of 1968. In fact, when I visited one college, they put me in, that they had a cyclone fence around the college, and they put me in this one facility. I found out later it was called the Bomb House, because someone had tried to bomb it from the road and thrown a bomb into it.
Unbelievable.
Yes, this is the way it was in Mississippi back then.
And did you have any fear about what you were doing and the repercussions it would cause?
Well, I was just brazen enough and young enough that it didn't bother me back then. I just kept on with my program, and I organized a loose group of mentors, of black mentors, who were in different departments at UMass to help oversee the lives of these black graduate students from the South that came into UMass. And this program continued after I left UMass. And I went back to the West Coast and went back to Oregon to work in environmental dynamics.
So, yeah, you left University of Massachusetts at that point.
In 1970,
and then I returned to Oregon to work on some of the issues
there. I worked environmental dynamics, carried out environmental consulting work, and had environmental seminars. And I worked on the entire scope of the firm's activities. And the main program we had, it was called the assisting various industries in the West Coast, in the, especially in the Northwest, to prepare wastewater discharge permit applications to the Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency.
So some progress had been made
this
after
the... before the Clean Water Act was passed. This was a precursor to the Clean Water Act.
Mm-hmm.
So these industries were having to deal with the environmental problems for the very first time. So we helped them get started. And while I was there, by the way, I taught an environmental survey course in the Department of Community Service and Public Affairs and beginning graduate students in the Department of Geography,
mm-hmm.
an environmental survey course on cleaning our environment.
So you had the teaching experiences that just really kept going throughout, no matter where you were.
That's right. And I was very fortunate while I was in Oregon to find out about a special environmental program overseas. It was called the Smithsonian Peace Corps Environmental Program, and it was located in Chile. And I was successful in getting being recruited for that program, and I was a visiting professor in the Faculty of Applied Mathematics and Engineering at the University of Chile for 2 years.
Now, what was it that exactly inspired you to pursue international work in the first place?
Well, I had always been interested in...
A boy from West Virginia. It's quite uncommon.
Was always interested in greater horizons. And I had always, even at Ohio Wesleyan, I had thought about the possibility of working overseas someday. And when I was at UMass, I was thinking about the possibility of working overseas someday. One of the black mentors for the program of black graduate students from the South had worked for the World Health Organization.
Oh.
And we talked a lot about his experiences overseas. And I was interested in the possibility of getting overseas, but I didn't know how to make the first step. So I was very fortunate to be recruited for this program, and I was visiting professor of environmental sciences at the University of Chile, and I was also an advisor to the Ministry of Public Health.
Now, how did you go about learning? You had to learn Spanish fluently.
That's right. Well, the Peace Corps sent us to there was a group of special Peace Corps volunteers under this environmental program. We got sent to Bogota, Colombia for a crash course in Spanish. All day long, nothing but Spanish.
Oh, my goodness.
So I was there for about 8 or 10 weeks.
Had you ever traveled outside the country before this point?
I had been just to Europe one time.
Okay, so you had never been to someplace like
South America. Never been to South America.
Very different experience.
Very different experience and very broadening. So I learned enough Spanish to get by. And when I was in Chile, they let me take 2 books from the course down to Chile with me. And I set up myself a self-teaching program and used the graduate students at the university to help me. And I continued on with my Spanish experience.
And you taught in Spanish.
And I taught in Spanish.
That
eventually.
Is very remarkable.
Eventually, I taught in Spanish.
At what age were you when this occurred?
Well, this was from January of 72 to September of 73 that I was down there. And let's see, that would have made me, 34 to 37.
That's not easy to learn a language in your
30s. Well, that was the first language I learned. I later on learned German and French when I was working further down the line at the UN in Vienna, but that's another story.
Yeah. Are there are any other experiences you wanted to share about the Peace Corps at that time?
Well, it was a very close-knit group. We knew each other all real well, and we helped each other out. And the Peace Corps rented housing for us all, which was very nice, very modest housing. I had a wife and 2 children at that time, and we had a three-bedroom house. No vehicle. We relied on public transportation except for the field work I did. We did a quarterly survey of surface water bodies in southern Chile that was established and also coordinated with the federal government officials. And then we also worked on the source of public water supply for Valparaiso and Viña del Mar over on the coast of Chile.
Did you see any improvements in the
situation? We did the baseline studies in all those bodies of water. Mm. There had never been any water quality work done in any of those bodies of water
before. So step one was assessment. How bad is it, or how much do we need to do to address it?
And we tried to emphasize to them not to be dumping any industrial waste in any of those bodies of water, because they all served as sources of drinking water.
Right.
And one more thing I did while I was there, in Paraguay, I presented a paper in Spanish to a regional meeting on public health that was sponsored by the Pan American Health Organization. That was really the culmination of my work down there. And I did the teaching responsibilities I had in the department included lecturing, and then the field studies I mentioned in the various lakes and surface water bodies, and then laboratory methods and water pollution studies. And I advised a lot of students on their theses, including industrial water use, wastewater discharges, and solid waste practices in the metropolitan area of Santiago.
Wow.
There were three principal technical reports that resulted from the field investigations that I was able to help carry out when I was down there.
So that was quite the you had a lot of experiences during that short time.
Sure. And one final experience with the government as an advisor to the director of the Environmental Health Service of Chile, I assisted in the preparation of the request by the Chilean government to the United Nations Development Program for a nationwide technical assistance program in the environmental sanitation sector. And then I left Chile at the finish of my experience there and went to Washington, D.C.
And there you were in Washington, D.C. for approximately a year.
A little over a year I was in Washington, D.C. And I started, actually, I don't think you were aware of this, but I worked for a consulting firm for some months called Linton, Mields & Costin. And I was in charge of the program for the it was called Urban and Environmental Studies, and the major project was a review of the deep tunnel and reservoir project for pollution abatement for the city of Chicago, and another study was an environmental study of alternative dam sites for future water supply for the northeastern United States.
Well, very relevant topics at that time, and important work to be done.
That's right, and at the same time, I was interacting with the Organization of American States in the Department of Regional Development, and I became a consultant to them. And while I was there, my project was to prepare a manual. It was called Environmental Considerations in the Planning and Evaluation of Development Projects in Latin America. And my work was also in close cooperation with the Office of Environmental and Health Affairs of the World Bank. And my work with the World Bank included developing a series of case studies based on World Bank programs. And I had to develop these anonymously because the World Bank couldn't have information on their actual countries that they were working on going out in the public. So I developed all these with fictitious titles of countries and cities and wrote six case studies. One on a hydroelectric power plant, a pulp and paper mill, a sewage treatment project, a water supply project, a nickel ore mining and refining project, and an iron ore mining and transport project. And the World Bank included this work as a part of their regular environmental program from then on for training their own people that came in.
It's interesting to me that during this time you had to create anonymous reports for these countries. Seems quite different today, where the public expects to have more transparency and information from companies throughout the world about their operations. So this is quite a change from the time that you were there.
I guess that's true.
So what happened after you were in Washington?
While I was in Washington, I went to the State Department and talked to the people in projects involving overseas activities in international organizations. So I got to know the fellow who was in charge of the Bureau of International Projects, and he said, after I showed him my resume and told him what I'd been doing, he said he thought he could place me in UNIDO, which is the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, headquartered in Vienna, Austria.
This comes to be quite important to my life.
Yes, that's where Christine was born.
Where you met my mother.
That's where I met Christine's mother, and where Christine and her sister were born.
So that was quite a fortuitous turn of events. You went to UNIDO, and this is in 1973 in Vienna, Austria.
Yes. And
What were some of the...
I was called an industrial development officer.
Uh-huh.
And I started out doing technical assistance. And we worked on projects in individual countries on environmental programs of various sorts. And then we later started cooperating with the United Nations Environment Program, which was relatively new at that time. So we worked on projects involving the Caribbean Sea, land-based sources of pollution in the Caribbean Sea, land-based sources of pollution in the Mediterranean Sea, and land-based sources of potential pollution in the Gulf of Guinea on the west coast of Africa. So,
what was the result of this work?
Well, we did. Well, for one thing, we had I was in charge of the first environmental program for West Africa. It was called a workshop sponsored by several UN agencies, including WHO, UNIDO, and UNEP, United Nations Environment Program. Workshop on the institution and coordination of national contingency plans for emergencies associated with industrial installations in the West and Central Africa region. And I prepared the technical background document called Industrial Emergency Contingency Planning for that workshop. And at that time, I gave the inaugural address in French.
Oh my goodness.
In Senegal.
So again, another language has been
added. That was after I had studied French for several years at the UN Language Center in Vienna, which is where I also studied and learned German in order to get around in Vienna in everyday life. But the German also turned out to be very useful in my work because it's a second language in many European countries.
Mm-hmm.
And UNIDO sent me to 22 different European countries while I was over there working for them on environmental problems.
Do you think that your liberal arts education is what helped you to learn languages or to be to desire to learn languages?
Well, I wanted to learn languages because I wanted to be able to communicate with people. So I actually continued my study of Spanish after I got to Vienna. I studied Spanish for another year, and I passed the highest level of language proficiency that they give. It's called the United Nations Proficiency Exam. I passed it in Spanish and also in French. They didn't give it in German because German is not an official language.
I see. So all in all, you were actually at UNIDO for the longest period out of any other position in
many,
your
career. Many years. And I was responsible for field projects, technical assistance projects, and the cooperative projects with UNEP and sectoral studies in various industrial sectors in more than 50 countries in Europe, Africa, the Caribbean, the Middle East, and South America.
So what do you feel, because you were there from 1973 to 1989, well, what do you feel about your legacy? What was your biggest, or what do you think are some of your legacies that you have from that work or have left behind, perhaps?
Well, I guess I left behind helped instill an appreciation for the importance of environmental considerations in industrial development projects. And that program has actually been expanded and at that, when I was there, I was in charge of not just technical documents, but also a broad overview called Environmental Protection Within the Context of the Work of UNIDO, the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, that was prepared for a special session of the Governing Council of the United Nations Environment Program. And another thing I was responsible for when I was at UNIDO was called the United Nations Organization, the Intersecretariat Group for Water. I represented UNIDO in that group, and we used to publish an annual review of water usage around the globe. But while it was not all work and no play when I was at UNIDO. I must say I was also very active in skiing. I had been a skier since my first days in Midland with Dow Corning, and I had skied also in South America in the Andes, and I became a very serious skier when I was in Austria because there was a UN ski club, and we went off into the Alps about every other weekend, and we took along Austrian ski instructors. So I was able to greatly improve my skiing, and after a few years in the club, I was elected president. And so I was responsible for taking many, many, many groups of skiers in buses out into the Alps for weekends and for longer trips. We used to go for 4 days at Easter every year.
So the trend of you having the position of president of an organization continues.
Yes, I guess so.
Very much a leader in your personality.
Well, when I was at UNIDO, I was also elected to represent my division in the staff council that oversaw activities of the staff in UNIDO. And I was actually elected also to what was called the Joint Appeals Board. The Joint Appeals Board heard cases in which someone wanted to protest an administrative decision of any sort that was directed against them. We had three members of this body that heard these various cases. And it was the first time in my life, actually, I was ever offered a bribe.
Oh, no.
Yes. Well, one fellow who did not win his case, by the way, offered me a bribe to swing the verdict in his favor.
Can you tell us what the bribe was, or is it too?
No, I'd rather not say what it was. It was up in the it was in the four figures.
Oh my goodness!
And but he unfortunately his record was not very good, and he failed in his attempt both to bribe the jury and also to secure a favorable response to his case.
Were there?
That's just an aside.
An aside, but quite an interesting experience. Are there other?
So after 15 years at UNIDO, the word began to filter around that the United States might be withdrawing. So there were rumors that the United States might be withdrawing, and they offered me a very favorable settlement if I would take early retirement. So I did, and it turned out to be fortuitous because about a year later, the United States withdrew, and the recruitment of UN officers from the United States essentially stopped.
And you were what age at this point when you retired?
I was in my mid-50s, 53, 54.
Right, so quite young.
I was quite young, yes.
I, at the time, of course, was about 4 years old.
Yes, Christine was quite young.
So I didn't know too much about what was happening at the time. But it turned out to be, I think, for the best, because we all packed up and moved back to Michigan.
We came back to Michigan. I wanted to come back here because of my ties. I still had ongoing ties with Michigan State, and I reestablished ties with several professors that I had had back then, and I got to know the people at the Writing Center of Michigan State University.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've actually done several kinds of activities since coming back and retiring, but the most important one, I suppose, was the editing. I proofed, edited, and revised more than 100 master's theses and PhD dissertations by Michigan State graduate students, and I charged very little for my services. This was my way of giving back to Michigan State for all the advantages that I had gotten, because really getting the PhD at Michigan State was the turning point in my career.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that really sent me on my way, was my PhD from Michigan State, and I've never forgotten that. So I really enjoyed the opportunity to edit and mentor master's and PhD students from various departments at Michigan State throughout my retirement from the UN.
And may I just say, you were quite instrumental in my decision to not only go to Michigan State for my bachelor's in political science, but now my PhD in forestry. So very lucky I actually got the editing services for free as opposed to the other students, although you charge such a small rate for that service. So it was really giving back to a lot of students that were in need of some assistance.
I also have edited several papers for external publication written by MSU faculty. And I edited two novels for commercial clients. And some of my clients outside of Michigan State were the National Science Foundation, various law firms, the supermarket chain of Aldi Incorporated, a firm sponsored by my other PhD daughter, my oldest daughter. It's called Dynamic Learner Consultants in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The University of Detroit, the University of Minnesota, Lansing Community College, and the Danube University in Vienna, Austria. These are other institutions from which I've edited manuscripts.
And it's really incredible to me. One of the greatest inspirations you've provided me in my professional and personal life is the foundation of solid writing skills. And I would say that it's quite unusual for someone with such a technical background in chemistry and physics and, you know, those types of sciences to have such strong writing skills. And I think it goes to show the broad and the breadth of education you received along the way.
Ohio Wesleyan was a great aspect of my writing skills. The most important course I took there was called report writing, and really taught me and honed my skills in being able to write.
And that's really one of the issues we face today that I think you're part of the solution, is really communicating science to a broader audience is so important nowadays.
In addition, since I've been back, I took up writing on my own account, and I wrote and self-published several short novels and one full-length novel. The most notable it's called A New Slain Knight, and the full-length novel was called The Way It Was. And recently I finished another one called The Chronicles of Jack Buck, and then I did a chapbook of poetry and short stories called The Eclectic Chapbook. And along the way, I did get several minor awards for published poems. I should mention that I was elected to the American Academy, the Academy of American Poets, and my biography has been published in 2,000 Notable American Men, the International Who's Who of Intellectuals, 10th Commemorative Edition, the Dictionary of International Biography, 23rd edition, and the International Authors and Writers Who's Who, the 13th and 14th editions.
That's quite incredible.
And most recently, a volume published by the International Biographical Center of Cambridge, England, called 2,000 Intellectuals of the 21st Century.
So this is quite big shoes to fill, might I add. But I'm a better person for it, because it's taught me to aim high, and clearly you continue to achieve even after retirement. That really wasn't a retirement. It's more working on projects that are in just a different field, basically.
I should mention also that I have dabbled in art, and I exhibit as Jack B., my first name and my middle initial. I had a one-man show in North Carolina. In Michigan, I had two one-man shows and two group shows with other artists, and then I had two shows in Austria. I was represented with five pieces in the Austrian art exhibit commemorating the 10th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in the USA, and one of those pieces was featured on Austrian national television that described the exhibition. And then I also had 19 works exhibited in a one-man show in Vienna, Austria. This was in 2011.
So very creative endeavors that you've
pursued. Well, I enjoyed doing that, and I was written up twice in the local newspaper for my art endeavors.
Yeah.
So that was more of a hobby, but I enjoyed it very much. And I should mention one more thing, and that is in the area of national security, the Federal Bureau of Investigation recruited me some years ago as a special consultant because of my broad international experience. I had work in 50 different countries, and after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, I had some interactions with the FBI over a period of about a year, and then they actually recruited me to work with them as a consultant until that period of time up through 2008 when I finally finished up with them.
Yeah.
And I just mentioned that I also have been a volunteer during the 2008 presidential election. I've been a patron of the Stratford Festival and also National Public Radio. I assisted in fundraising for the WKAR, the National Public Radio Station in East Lansing, the American Heart Association, the March of Dimes, and St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee.
And there are quite a few other charities that you regularly contribute to and assist in their efforts.
There are some others, yes. And also, in conclusion, I mentioned, in just this past year, I participated in a special letter-writing campaign under the auspices of the League of Conservation Voters in order to help get out the vote.
Great. So your public life has just continued in just a different realm. And you've been able to utilize all of your expertise and skills to help push these causes forward.
Well, I've tried, Christine. And I just wanted to say that I'm very proud of the legacy that I left in the form of my children. Very soon I'll have two daughters with PhDs and one daughter who's a registered nurse and has a bachelor's degree in nursing from the University of Mass. And the other daughter has a master's degree in occupational therapy and is working in that field here in Michigan.
And I think I speak for my three sisters by saying that really there are no words for the immense inspiration you've been to us as, you know, just a person, but also professionally. And that phrase of "you have to stick to it" is something that all of us have heard many times from you during difficult times in our lives, but it's been very important for us to keep that in the forefront. You have to stick to it. And I think your career and your perseverance has really taught us to achieve and aim high and not be limited by naysayers, really, but to believe in yourself.
Thank you very much, Christine. And it's been a great pleasure to watch you grow and develop. And in the next year, I hope you'll finish your PhD. And I want to thank you very much for organizing this living history opportunity to come back and speak here at the Michigan State University Library about my life and times.
And I enjoyed it as well, Dad, and I'm so glad we got to do this. And hopefully, before long, we'll be inaugurating the grandchildren and the next generation into Michigan State life and really being a true Spartan through and through. So thanks so much, Dad, and love you very much. I'm so glad we got to do this.
Thank you, Christine.